Because we've got no extra chairs, so I didn't want to take it on.
Right. Okay, great.
You guys are crazy.
I won't get it, he doesn't work.
We can't have all this dislocation tonight. This is crazy. Excuse me. Milt, you got to sit on your side.
You need a chair.
We have seats.
Can people grab a Tanakh or a Torah? Or,
sure.
You know, a
we can do whatever you want us to do.
I was wondering. Thank you.
Yeah, here.
Another one.
Right. Well, you are the Chumash.
Yeah, yeah. Tanakh.
Where's Tanakh?
That's totally hypothetical.
Yeah, my brother.
I see.
I'm sorry, Joe.
Oh. I have my own. Thank you. No, I have my own.
Oh, so I thought you asked.
For you. Well, good for you.
There's
very
something,
good.
Something in the air, because when I open this up, it's the Kedoshim. You know the first pasuk, right? Do you remember?
We don't have any Tanakh here, John.
There aren't. I mean, just enough that you have. What you need is Devarim Aleph, right? Deuteronomy 1, which is what we're dealing with by and large here. You should be here.
No wonder why you can't sell your business. Or shine down or whatever you want to go. You told me. What is that?
In the top?
Yeah.
Deuteronomy 1:16.
You said you can't retire yet.
All right, I think we'll start, yeah?
Sure.
Should we wait a little more? It's 8.
Wait till
5
after. Oh, we wait till 3 after. But the character people won't be here.
Understood.
So Henry's not here and Jay's not here. The Solomon character people. And we don't know where the callers are. They usually come. Does anyone know where the young couple is? With the young couple? We haven't seen the young couple for a few weeks. That's right. She had a baby. I saw them the other week. She's on postdoc as well. She's very proud. In her field, is extraordinarily few.
I need to know in 60 grams.
She
like a fellowship?
No. She's going to specialize in pediatric anesthesia. And there's very few hospitals in the world that offer the specialty training in pediatrics. So she was able to, she won
the
position
at the Elks. I saw you the other day.
Oh,
when? I was in a cab on Park Avenue, and you were with your son. It was very sweet that you were in a very engaged conversation, the two of you. You were waiting for the light. Yeah, it was very sweet.
Well, we're waiting a few minutes.
He's living.
Oh, I'm terrible. I never had a problem with starting like 5 minutes early.
I was told Minhag HaMakom is 3 minutes. Is that right?
Right.
No, that's what I'm
saying.
Start?
Yeah.
Okay, I will start. So, hello. If you don't know who I am, I'm Joe Schwartz. It's been my honor to be the rabbinic intern at Or Zeruah this year. And this is by far the most daunting job I'll have, which is, I mean, Rabbi Wechsler is among many things, he's a brilliant scholar of Talmud. I've taken a few Talmud classes, so there's a big gulf between us, but I'm prepared, and I think we'll have a good conversation today. So I thought we'd start just by reminding ourselves where we are. Say again? Turn it off?
Turn it on.
Is it on?
I think I turned it on.
Check.
Looks like it's recording.
Like timing itself?
It's recording. I see it timing.
Yeah, it's even like sprinkling.
So let's remind ourselves where we are. I listened to the last class, so I had a sense of where we were, right? So we were on Sanhedrin 7b. We last class was 7b3, by and large. And we're talking about kind of words of caution, wonderful stories and adages and laws, words of caution to judges. Right? This is most of what we're talking about here is the sorts of things that judges should be very alert to, cautious of, and so forth. And halfway through what you did last week, we switched into, you take the Tanakhim, we switched into reading Moshe's statement about the creation of subordinate courts, if you remember. So that's Dvarim Aleph 16. Everyone just take a peek there. This is a good thing to have ringing in your ears as we learn, because basically what the rabbis do through most of these dafim is just expand on these verses, right? So the better you know them, the more you understand what they're up to. So I'm at 16. Everyone with me? Va'atave et shofteichem ve'et ha'hi. And the rabbi pointed out that the Chazal, when they heard the language of Sivui there, Sav, understood that something unusual was happening. Some sort of, the word that was offered here, which was great, was a prod. Some sort of extra prod was being offered. Moshe wasn't content simply to say, do this, but rather, do this with an edge to it. And so much of what's going on here is sussing out, what is that edge that's behind Moshe's words here? What is it that he's pushing the courts to really be cautious and alert to? Va'atzaveh et shofteichem ve'et ahi. So I commanded that you have judges at that time. Lemor shamoa ben acheichem ushvatem tzedek ben ish uvein achiv. Saying, heed, or listen, between fellows, and judge them justly, or righteously. Tzedek, ben ish uvein achiv, between one man and his brother or fellow, uvein gero. Remember what the rabbis did with gero in the daf? What's the pshat of gero? The ger.
Stranger.
The stranger, right? Did we spend a little time on this? I remember we quickly jumped over this, right? The simple meaning of the word here is between a man and his brother and between the stranger, gero. But that is not at all the way the rabbis read it. They were talking about the migurim, the what the rabbi called the appurtenances in an apartment, right, or in a house that has to be divided among the case that's brought is, this is from last week, the case that was brought is two brothers that inherit a house, right, how the division is actually going to have to happen. And they read into these verses, these very simple verses here, a great deal. And among the things they read in is you shouldn't be content to give one brother the attic and the other the ground floor and say, that's fine, you both have a place to live. That's right, you have to do an assessment. You have to do an assessment, and you have to divide it fairly according to the value of the house. And they read from gero, which the simple meaning, the pshat of that is the stranger. Here they say, no, that means the appurtenances, those things of value in the house, which are beyond the physical space, those also have to be divided evenly and assessed fairly, which is kind of a wild read. It's interesting always when the rabbis depart so dramatically from the shot of the text, right? Why it is they're doing that. But here they read a tremendous amount into gero.
It's not too wild, because gero, Gentiles who come and live among the Jews, these are the gerim. So it has to do with dwelling either way.
For sure. So the root of the word in both cases is lagur, gar, right? A thing that dwells. But between to say you should do justice not only to Jews, but to the foreigner or the resident alien, which is the pshat, and to read that to mean you have to assess the value of all those appliances that add value to a house, that's quite a stretch.
You live in the same house.
I mean, I think you're right. Definitely, they're not straying so wildly, but okay. Yeah.
It's more likely to be a very common problems that come because of that division of property rather than something that comes from the stranger. So, I mean, it's kind of telling you what were the common problems that the rabbis would see in Talmudic days.
was much more among fellows and property than it was.
That's excellent. That's excellent. I think that's right. And I think there's another reason that's driving them to read it this way, which is that by the time the rabbis are writing, the ger, as it exists in the Torah, has become a null set. Right? The ger in the Torah's worldview is somebody that's not a Jew, but lives among Jews within the sovereign territory of the Jews. By the time the rabbis are writing, a ger becomes, a convert. That's right, a proselyte. A giyur, right. They invent a verb, ligayer, or the hitgayer, to become a Jew. So then reading this through a rabbinic lens, that verse means do justice between a man and his fellow and the convert. But that doesn't make sense, because the convert clearly has the same legal status as a Jew. Furthermore, the Jews only really have jurisdiction over other Jews when they're writing this. So therefore, the word ger has to mean something else, and what they choose to make it mean, as you put it, I think exactly right, something that has relevance to them in their own world, right?
I wasn't aware that the word gear comes from the same shoresh of war.
That's right.
So in that sense, inanimate objects that are residing in a property, you could actually make that.
Precisely. That's precisely what you were saying. That it's not so
you're
so. All right, let's continue through the round 17. Lo takiru fanim bamishpat. Now we're going to reach this today, but I just want to read through the psukim with you. Lo takiru fanim bamishpat, kakaton kagadol tishmaun. Now, literally, you should not recognize a face when you judge. You should not know a face. That's an idiom. It's something like, don't take account of the identities of the parties. Something like that. Don't take into account who these people are. Kakaton kagadol tishmaun. Listen alike to the small and the large.
Weak or the strong.
Say again?
Weak or the strong.
Weak or strong. Lo taguru mipnei ish, ki amishpat lelohim hu. Being not afraid of a human being, because judgment is God's. Very suggestive phrase. V'adavar asher yikshem mikem takrivun elai ushmativ. And that matter which is too difficult for you, bring it close, or bring it to me. That's Moshe speaking. Bring it to me, ushmativ, and I will hear it. I'll hear that case. And then the final line, va'atzave etchem be'et ahi et kol hadvarim asher ta'asun. And I commanded you at that time regarding all the things that you should or must do. That's the kind of the body of law that creates the first court system, essentially. That's the statement. That's the constitution of the courts. And so what the rabbis are doing here is reading through those psukim very carefully and drawing out the implications. So we stopped last class with the line uvein ben ish uvein achiv uvein gero, between a man and his fellow and the stranger, which they read to mean, and the appliances, repurposes. Yeah. So now we're on page 7b4 in the Schottenstein. And if you're not in the Schottenstein, we're at the very very end of 7b. Okay? All right, I've prepared my own little sheet here, too.
This is comforting. It's a very short page.
So it quotes the beginning of Pasuk 17. Lo takiru fanim bamishpat. Everyone with me?
Yeah.
Rabbi Yehuda omer lo takrehu. So Rabbi Yehuda says, now there's going to be a disagreement on what exactly that verse means. Rabbi Yehuda says, you should not know him. That seems to kind of repeat what was said, but let's get the whole dispute out there, and then we'll figure out what's going on. Rabbi Elazar Omer, lo tinakrehu. You should not distance yourself from him or be hostile to him. Okay? So now that's just, this is a kind of a standard move, right? You have just two schools of thought recorded over the meaning of a verse. Before we turn to Rashi, Rashi's there to resolve all our difficulty. I lean more heavily, I think, than the rabbi does on Rashi, which is absolutely his privilege. He can see Rashi and then leave Rashi behind. I hold on to Rashi for dear life whenever I read Gemara. So I will be turning to Rashi here. So Rashi takes this in one direction. But what do you think is up? I mean, before we turn to Rashi, what is the Gemara telling us here? What is this disagreement about? Yeah.
That if you know the guy, you shouldn't be his judge. And on the other hand, if you don't know the guy, don't be against him.
If you don't know the guy, don't be against him. I like it. So let's put the two schools. But Rabbi Yehuda says, you should not know him. Lo takrihu.
So if I'm a judge and somebody comes in front of me and I know the guy, I should...
Recuse yourself. So if you are... If you, sorry?
They call it, is that conflict of interest or is that just...
Yeah, in a sense, right? Appearance of impropriety, a bias, or whatever.
Now, there's a problem with that, if that's what it means. Right? The problem with that is that they're not living in New York City. Right? I mean, these are small communities. It's unlikely that a judge is going to be completely unfamiliar with any litigant that comes before him. So, which is not to say it's not plausible. That really could be what Rabbi Yehuda is saying. Literally, if you actually know one of the litigants, you have to recuse yourself as a judge. But if that's his rule, it's a very onerous rule. But that's impossible. And so if that's what Rabbi Yehuda is saying, then what's Rabbi Elazar saying? Lo tina krehu. Yeah, don't distance yourself from him or be hostile to him, perhaps.
Don't be cold to him.
Don't be cold to him.
Well, you could do the same thing if you know somebody well. I mean, if you know somebody, you could, in order to show your impartiality, actually, you know, kind of rule against them or try to overcompensate by doing that.
That's excellent. So in other words, we can fill out, so Rabbi Elazar is saying, no, that's preposterous, Rabbi Yehuda. Right, that's preposterous. How can you recuse yourself from every case that comes before you where you know one of the parties? That can't be what the Torah is telling us. Instead, what it's telling us is, don't adjust your behavior toward the litigant on the basis of your relationship with him, whether make yourself more hostile or make yourself more partial.
First person who recognizes the litigant, it goes further than to recognize him and to love him. And the second one, Rabbi Elazar says if you hate him, it's kind of extremes more than just knowing someone and someone being a stranger. I don't know.
We're jumping the gun a tiny bit because what the commentary here does, what the translation does here is it dips into Rashi. And it brings sort of as the pshat of the Gemara, as the simple meaning of the Gemara, what Rashi reads into it, right? Which is not a far-fetched thing to do. I mean, I think if you just had the words alone here, you would be dangling like I am all the time before I turn to Rashi, sort of holding on for dear life. And then Rashi helps to fill out the thought. But that is what Rashi is going to say. But before we turn to Rashi, I was hoping we could, you know, come to some conclusions ourselves about what the disagreement between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Elazar is actually about. And I think we have a good proposal here. Yeah.
I mean, I think there are two ways to approach justice. One is to say, and it's pretty close to our system, which would be, while judges will not recuse themselves just because they know a lawyer, I think typically a judge would not sit on a case if they know the party. I have that one of my former partners, who's now a judge in the New York Court of Appeals, did not recuse himself in the same-sex marriage case, which was argued by one of my partners with whom he was a partner. He decided that case. But we have another case involving a partner as a party, and he recused himself. So that's not uncommon. Here, I think, and the other approach would be to say, which I guess is Rashi's point of view, the first approach says the judges are not going to be able to prevent themselves from being biased, so you're out if you know the party. Here, it's the judge is supposed to be neutral. Even there's some other pasuk someplace where it says, you know, don't favor the poor, right? Someplace.
Mm-hmm.
Don't favor the poor, which is kind of, you know. So I think that approach says the judges have to they have to conquer their instincts or whatever. They have to. A good judge is one who is able, and he has to, or she has to, make sure that she puts aside all the feelings about people, even if you know them. You just have to do the law, which is probably easier when you think you're doing something that God is instructed.
Interesting. So that's how, the latter is how I read Rabbi Elazar. That is to say, don't adjust your feelings toward the parties based on your knowledge of them. But if we're understanding this as a machloket between the two, as a disagreement, then that's not what Rabbi Yehuda is saying. He's actually saying the first, don't know them at all. That is, I'm not trusting you to remain impartial. If you know one of the litigants, refuse yourself. But Rabbi Elazar says, no. Now that, again, that's my own understanding of what's going on. That's not what Rashi thinks. So let's just turn to Rashi so we follow the main thrust, right? Rashi says, and it's basically what the Schottenstein gives you, lo takirehu, that's the language of Rabbi Yehuda, you should not know him, im hu ohavcha, if he is someone that loves you, that is, pretend as though you don't know him, if he's someone that's favorably disposed toward you. And then Rabbi Elazar's language, lo tinakrehu, im hu sonecha, if he's someone that despises you, lo ta'aselo kinochri lechayavo, don't make him into someone who is, as it were, a goy, a nochri. He's playing on the word linaker, to estrange. A nochri is another word for non-Jew. So don't make him into somebody who you would be disposed to rule against in order to find him liable. I'm not quite sure how Rashi understands this as a dispute, because those are actually two views that could be reconciled. In some sense, Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Elazar on Rashi's girsa are kind of seeing eye to eye. Right? It's not a machloket between them. They're basically saying the same thing. That is, if he's favorable to you, be fair. If he dislikes you, be fair.
Hard to know. I mean, when it was originally, mentioned, doesn't say Rabbi says this, but Rabbi says that.
Nope, it just brings the two views. It just brings the two views, but that's often the way it brings a machloket, to just simply bring two views.
But Rashi could combine them.
He does. And I think what Rashi is doing, I try to figure out what is making Rashi go depart this far, at a different place, in Ketubot 105b, which the Tosafot is going to turn us to later on, there's a similar discussion about when judges should recuse themselves. And there Rav Papa says, lo lidon inish dina leman derachim le. You should not rule in favor of an individual because you love him, velo leman disane le, and not because you hate him. Derachim le lo chazi le chova. Because when you love somebody, you generally can't see what's wrong with them or when they're liable. Disane le lo chaze le zechuta. And when you despise somebody, you usually can't see the merit or the good point. Now, my hunch is Rashi knows that passage, of course, and he's bringing that to bear here and is sort of imposing Rav Papa's adage on this little disagreement, which I do think is maybe, I'm not sure if it's, yeah.
One question of love and hate, I'm not clear, unless it's from some other source, why Rashi brings that in. It's not really in the text. The other thing is, I think Rashi says, if don't favor him if he loves you, and don't rule against him if he hates you. And
that's right.
In the English translation says, if you love him, which kind of easier to absorb where Rashi.
That's true. Now, of course, that's all. The difference between one or the other is where you place a vav. If it's ahuvcha, is somebody who is beloved of you. Ohavcha is someone that you love. It's possible that we have different manuscripts of Rashi, right? And somewhere he said one, and somewhere he said the other. This is always a possibility. In fact, I was thinking as I was listening to last class. If you remember, Tosafot seems to utterly disagree with their grandfather, with Rashi, on a point. Right, they instill the fear of heaven in people by putting the latch right on the table, and Tosafot says, no, don't put the fear of heaven into them, which was shocking, because how could Tosafot be so against Rashi? I had a hunch, maybe Rashi actually had a low in his original statement. That is, Rashi and Tosafot actually agreed, only our version of Rashi got corrupt. Could be. could be. And those sort of the placement of a vav makes a big difference.
Is that part of the reading of Rashi? I mean, is that the way scholars like yourself would think about
yeah,
Rashi?
You can.
That it's just a...
Scholars unlike me do that, yeah.
No, I mean, when you...
Yes, definitely.
That might be a corrupted manuscript that wound up in...
I think they would need something more than a hunch. They would have to have a manuscript somewhere.
Outside of this particular, in other words, in Rashi general.
Yeah, there are multiple manuscripts of all of these things, and the version we have here collates and collects and amends based on what they think the most plausible reading is. And there's a lot of work to be done there. I mean, these were, you know, up until the 15th century, these were all copied by hand. So a vav and a yud is really the difference of a millimeter, you know, and that can change the meaning. So there's a lot of work that's done there. And actually, there's wonderful stuff. Yeah, sorry, Mira.
No,
go for it.
Offer a small linguistic solution, because through many, many centuries, the word ohev is used not just for love, as we understand the word love, but as a friend throughout the literature, and I know that one. So it could mean your friend. When you have a friend, you love him and he loves you, so it's not who loves whom, it's a friend. And that's clearly the word ohavim is friends.
Excellent.
Same goes for soneh. Soneh can be enemy. An enemy, it's mutual hatred. So you don't have to say who hates whom. It's mutual. And that combines the whole thing.
Excellent.
Friend
Excellent.
And enemy.
We don't even need to hypothesize about corrupt Rashi. There you go. Great.
Thank you.
So now we have... You know, this is what an interesting thing that, you know, as you've seen throughout this class, is this weaving together of halakha and agadah, right? So now, after we had some sort of halakha, some sort of prescription for what a judge should do, we go to an anecdote, right? It's a great anecdote. I'm going to mess up the Aramaic all over the place. I don't speak it terribly well, but I'll do my best. If my vowels are wrong, correct me. Okay, thank you.
Inquiry.
Oosh. Ush piz chine de rav ata lekame ledina. So this is a host, yes? A host of rav. That is, someone that had in the past been his landlord, been his host, he had been his guest, came before rav to hear a case. So rav was the sitting judge, and this man who had been his host comes before him. Amar lo. He said to rav, he looked up, he recognized who he was, Lav Ushpiz Chane At, weren't you my guest? Right? Amar Lo'in. Rav knows exactly who this is. He says, yeah, I was. That's right. Rav is not kind of scratching it. He knows very well who this is. Amar Le Dina Idli. He says, wouldn't you know it? I have a case. In other words, you're going to hear my case. Amar Le Silnalach Ledina. I am Pasul. This is what Rav responds. I'm out. I am not on this case. And there's a nice little seal now. And there's a kind of emphasis. For me, I'm out of this matter. I can't hear your case. Amar le Rav l'Rav Kahana, huk dine. So Rav, having recused himself, he goes over to Rav Kahana, and he says, would you sit and hear this case? Now I'm leaning on Rashi already to make sense of who's doing what, because not only do they leave out the names, they also leave out the pronoun. So it's entirely unclear who's doing what, but it becomes pretty clear that it is now Rav Kahana who sees that this would-be litigant is being familiar or haughty, guys, being sort of pally, in his attitude toward Rav. Amarle, so Rav Kahana says to this former host of Rav, E tzayata tzayata. If you want to obey this court, or obey me, obey it. Ve e lo mefik nalach Rav me'oncha. Now here we actually do have a girsa problem, and some people correct the girsa, but let's just go with this one. Girsa, a version, a redaction, an addition, addition. If you don't want to obey the court, I am going to push out or knock you out knock out Rav from your power. Very unclear phrase, so that we go to Rashi to understand what's being said there. Rashi explains, Odiacha, and also in Hebrew, that's part of why I love going to Rashi, because Rashi generally writes in Hebrew, and then I'm good to go, right? Odiacha she'ein Rav yechol l'sayecha. I'm going to let you know right now, says Rav Kahana, Rav is going to be no help to you. He has no power to help you. Dimashtina lecha. When I excommunicate you.
The rain may judge you.
All right. So now this is a wonderful agadah. I mean, it's wonderful for many reasons. You heard the facts, right? You heard as it's reported. And everyone with me in the Gemara?
Excommunicate. Had a prejudgment.
Well, so I don't quite know what's going on here. Here's my guess. The threat of excommunication is really something akin to contempt of court. Right? It's not, in other words, it's not a judgment about the merits of the case. It has to do with whether or not this litigant is willing to recognize and abide by the authority of the court and not attempt to influence matters in some sort of untoward way. I don't think he's prejudging this man's matter. But he is prejudging this guy's attitude based on nothing more than something he kind of catches, right? His behavior, although no behavior is actually recorded, right?
He said to him, you need to obey the rules of the court.
Mm-hmm.
That means, if he says it to him, that means he doesn't obey the rule of the court.
You're saying because Rav Kahana told him you have to obey,
that something happened that he didn't obey.
But we don't know that. I mean, it could mean that, but just going on the Agadah that we have, right? Rav Kahana sees something in this man's behavior toward Rav, and based on nothing more than that comes this ferocious, right, response. Litigant, if you want to obey the authority of this court, you do that. And if not, watch out, you're going to be excommunicated, or you're going to be held in contempt. Now, it's possible that there's something missing. That is, this man did something more than simply say to Rav, which is all that we have, weren't you my guest? Which is all that we have him saying. Which is, again, depending on the way it's being said and by whom, it could mean a lot. But that's partly why this is a great Agadah. Because it's not a clear-cut case. None of this is clear-cut. Yeah.
I know you. I mean, he could have said something very respectful that built up Rav. But instead, he phrased it in a way to make Rav obliging or, you know, beholden to his, in front of everybody in the court. And that's enough to tip people off, that you are already, instead of putting him to be the person of authority, you're already saying, weren't you the one that owes me something? I mean, he's saying that
absolutely.
You owe me for something before. So he's setting up the wrong equation there, right?
And that's certainly the way Rav saw his statement, right? In other words, if it was just a familiar remark, it wouldn't have been enough to make Rav say, that's it, I'm recusing myself. But the fact that he did means there was something in his statement that at least set off Rav.
Well, it says in the text, Chazei d'ahava kai. He was displaying a intimate attitude toward Rav. Haughty.
Now, but is that referring to the statement that he made to Rav, weren't you my guest? Or was there some other conduct that isn't reported in this Agadah? Right?
Sounds like he went up to him, like, put his arm around him and said, hey, yeah, I know you. You're my buddy. he's lording over him, or like at least his equal.
It could be, but then again, why wouldn't that part of the story be reported? If, you know, that's quite a thing. Then the litigant went up to Rav and threw his arm around him and said, hey, you know, how are you enjoying those candies I sent you last week?
But I think each one could have had some mutual embarrassment about whatever occurred while one was the guest and one was the host, and neither one of them really wants to be reminded of this. And I appreciate what Bobby said about the manner, but I almost think that the manner didn't matter. It was the reminder of what they both had put away far in the ground and don't want to reappear. So for both of them, it's much better that they separate now, for both of them. It's a mutual benefit. And Rav Kahani picks up that Rav had something that he was embarrassed about, even if it happened 20 years ago, And he may be surprised that Rob has that in his own background. And I think we see that with when we look at presidential candidates and we learn something that happened 20 years ago and we think, oh my, how does that affect how we think about them today? Even though it happened when they were younger men and less confident. That's what I mean. Or from what you said.
So let's just think, what's interesting about this, right, is let's think about the editing choice that's made here. This Agadah is brought after the discussion of Lo Takir Ufanim, right? Do not be partial in judgment. Suppose for a moment it was brought in an earlier part. In other words, it was up to the editors of the Sugya, right, the Ba'alea Sugya, to insert this anecdote wherever they liked. Suppose they placed it in the part where Tosafot said, you should not put too much fear into the people. That is, treat the people with respect. That's where they had inserted this story. What then would have been, do you think, the lesson in the Agadah? You following what I'm saying?
Well,
overreaction.
The overreaction.
Right.
Before, you know, you said that nothing happened to you, but he mentioned in his conversation with Rav, you remember I gave you a favor, I made a favor with you.
Huh?
So he already expressed you owe me something. And Rav Kahana held it.
That's right. I think that's what the father was saying.
That's already, that's what happened here.
What I'm suggesting, though, is that we're inclined to find Rav Kahana's reaction here justified, partly because of where in the sugya this anecdote was brought. Yeah.
Right. Going back to your question, Tosafot, they would have said, judge, respect the litigant, gives the litigant respect. That would not... That does not seem to be what Rav Kahana is doing. Rav Kahana, before he's judging anything, he's already saying to this litigant that, you know, obey my law, my decree, or else I'm to be held in contempt, excommunicated. So he's not giving the respect that Tosafot was talking about.
But there is a case here. He already initiated an issue that is already in front of the judges that were, and that's the problem. It's not that it started differently elsewhere. That statement of his already written in the papers of the court. So he's already initiated an activity that was already negative to the court.
Mm-hmm.
Mini Christ incident here is provoked perhaps partly by the litigant, mainly by Ruff, by his reaction. But a judge probably has a lot of people sending candy, they know each other anyway. So his reaction would have played a schmo, I'm a judge, I render justice. He reacts immediately by withdrawing. No such luck. I'm accusing myself. He has no time to pick over the case. Rav Kahana must have sensed Omrad, whether he actually witnessed what happened or Rav went to him. But he reacts very strongly, and probably based on the way in which the story is related to him. So the question is, did Rav have to accuse himself of a case like this? Or was this a personal kind of sonne of this guy? the guy thinks he'll get favorable treatment because of the ahava, but Rob sees it in quite a different way. But in either case, he's supposed to judge the case regardless of how.
Excellent. So right.
Why does he recuse himself?
That's excellent. We're going to turn to Tosafot, who's going to actually ask that very question as well. But I just want to drill down this one point, which is the way that the law is influencing our reading of the Agadah. In other words, we are reading this Agadah with ringing in our head the language of Dvarim. Don't be partial to litigants. It's a little bit of a strange story to illustrate that, because to me the most dramatic element of this is not Rav's recusal, but Rav Kahana's kind of furious, you know, reply or, you know, charge to this litigant, right? And you, again, you think about, you have the editor, you know, the editor has at his disposal hundreds upon hundreds of stories he could bring. He chooses to bring this one here, right? Which means he has a read of what this, of what the story is about, and he has a read of what that law is about, and the one is supposed to complement the other. But it's not the only read of this anecdote. This anecdote could really be a story about how Rav Kahana behaved atrociously toward anyone that came before him. And he, you know, if we learned later, I mean, God forbid, this is not true, but were we to learn later that Rav Kahana was forcibly removed from hearing cases because he was seen to be too abusive, this would be a wonderful story to give an example about Rav Kahana's temper. Right? I mean, that's not the use it's being brought to, but that's the very interesting thing about the way that narrative and law can interact. Yeah, but... It tells us several things. It tells us the age of the story, which we could also date by the people involved. I'm not great at the toldot, the kind of the generations of all the different Amoraim, but this is a story about figures that appear throughout the Talmud who are living in Bavel, who spoke Aramaic. So this is a story about them as they live. It's their contemporaries, and it doesn't originate in Eretz Yisrael, where later than here the language was still Hebrew. So it's a lived story. It's probably an actual anecdote, highly edited, highly stylized, but an actual anecdote of something that happened.
But what's the next step? We haven't finished.
Wait, we haven't finished. That's the whole of the anecdote. That's the whole of the anecdote. And it's very interesting for that reason. So the question is raised, did Rav have to recuse himself? Right? So here's what Tosafot says. Let's look, if you want to look with me. We are on 8a. And it's on the outside of the page. You can see Tosafot. You always do, you know how to distinguish Tosafot from Rashi? This
yeah.
Rashi is always on the toward the margin, right? So that the worms eat him last, is what he's saying, right? Most important. So Tosafot's on the outside of the page, and it's a very short one. Psil nalecha, or lach. Yeah? So here's what Tosafot says. Psil na lach. I am pasul. I am... I'm not a valid judge for you. Marchik hayasmo. Rav distanced himself, or maybe this was customarily what he would do. Rav either did here or would routinely, depending on how you understand Tosafot's Hebrew. It could mean either he did distance himself or he would routinely distance himself. That is, he felt that he ought not to hear this case. Aval min hadin lo mifsil. But legally speaking, according to the law of Nogea B'Zavar, of when you are implicated in the matter, Rav did not have to recuse himself, says Tosafot. V'chem ahu d'shani d'ayene gzeirot d'ayte le sana d'pri, or d'piri. And they say, and the same is true for the one that taught, that is the Bala Sugiya, the one who taught about judges who heard matters in which they could impose fines, who brought him, full and clear, a basket of fruit. Now they're referring us back over to Ketubot 105b, which was what I thought Rashi had in mind earlier as well, which as I mentioned is a whole list of wonderful anecdotes of sort of extremely upright judges who recused themselves on the slightest provocation. And the story is told there, I'm just going to quickly summarize that I wrote it down for myself, of Rabbi Yossi, who was a landlord. And regularly on Fridays, his tenant farmer would bring him fruit from his own garden as rent. But he was hearing the case on Thursday, which was market day, which was the day when the court was in session. And that day, his tenant farmer came to him with a basket of fruit. And he said, what's up? Why the change? And the tenant farmer said, I had actually a matter to hear, a case here, and so I figured on the way, he uses the language on the way, he says, it's wonderful, he says, agav orche, you know, while I was at it, I might as well bring these to my lord. to Lamar, to my lord. Lo kabel mine. Yossi wouldn't, Rabbi Yossi wouldn't take that basket. Amar le sil nalach ledina. He uses the same language as Rav. He said to him, I am pasul. I can no longer hear your matter. Otiv zuza de rabbanan v'ka dinin le. So he personally, Rabbi Yossi did, arranged to have two other judges hear this man's case. And this is wonderful. V'hadi de kazio v'ate amar I baitain hachi v'I baitain hachi. And here Rashi was very helpful. That is, Rashi says, as he was doing this, for the sake of the, you know, that this man's case be heard fairly, he couldn't stop thinking to himself, huh, you know, if he wants to, my tenant farmer could argue this way. No, that's not a good argument, so he could argue this way. So that's he can't help this going through his mind. Amar. Sorry, wait, Amar. Tepach naf sham shel mikable shochad. May the souls of those who actually accept bribes be damned. Uma ni shelo natalti, ve'im natalti sheli natalti. Because for me, who didn't actually take anything, and even had I taken it, right? Even had I taken it, I would have been doing nothing more than taking what's rightfully mine. In other words, I was going to get that basket of fruit tomorrow, so I get it today. There's no big difference, right? And I didn't even take that basket of fruit. But if even I can't help, in some sense, being an advocate on behalf of this man, kach mekable shochad al achad kama v'chama. How much worse is it for those that actually take bribes that they couldn't help themselves but be corrupt in the judgments they render? It's a great story. And what Tosafot is saying is, there as well, the refusal to, or it's not entirely clear, either the refusal to take the basket of fruit, or having refused to take the basket of fruit, the refusal to hear the case, was lifni mishurat hadin, was over and above the requirements of what the law would require. And so that's Tosafot's answer to the question. Was this actually required of Rav? They say no. This was sort of, you know, righteous conduct, but not strictly required.
Because it also looks bad. Even if it isn't bad, it looks bad.
But looking bad can itself be illegal. In other words, the appearance of impropriety can itself be a reason to recuse yourself, legally speaking. This was even beyond that.
Right. There's an interesting, just one point, maybe this is worth mentioning. So the host, so to speak, I originally thought this meant he was the owner of a hotel, you know, of a waster, but it doesn't mean that, I take it. It's just that he's the person who gave him hospitality.
Sounds like it.
So he's very gushing, you know, aren't you my guest? It wasn't great. And Rob's answer is pretty cold, right? Yes. You know, it's not like, oh, it's great to see you, that was a wonderful time, you know, and all those things you would normally do. It's just really cold. So maybe part of also what's going on is, I wasn't here for this, but I just saw earlier, that you're not supposed to, let's say, plead your case without the other litigant present. This isn't exactly, maybe the custom was each person, litigant, is supposed to pick his own judge and they get together, but he's saying too much to the judge. It's an ex-party communication talking to the judge about his past.
Tell me, Jonathan, did you read ahead a tiny bit?
On the
duff, because it's amazing. You're anticipating the exact next piece of the duff.
No, I was catching. I don't know. I thought I was catching up from.
No. I think that's great. I mean, that's wonderful, right? So, in other words, the problem with there's a problem with that, right? The problem with that. Yeah, go ahead.
Now, you were just saying that this was aside from the court. My assumption the whole time was that it was in court with the both litigants there. So Rob recused himself. And Kahani had to show that he was fair to both. And maybe that's why he came so hard on the first one. But if you're saying this was not even, he may not have even been there. So the question is why he overreacted like that. So are we assuming that this was outside the court?
We're assuming whatever you want to assume. This is what's great about the story. The story comes where it comes and it only tells you what it tells you. And I don't know. I mean, the problem, right? is that this is introduced with a line of not being favorable, right? This story is prompted by a law about not being favorable. So we're searching that story for evidence of potential conflicts or potential biases, right? But now perhaps we're searching it for something else, which is some other form of impropriety which was not about that law, even though that's where the editor decided to insert the story, right? And in fact, what's interesting, I mean, it's a strange coincidence that you brought that example up, is that the subsequent rule, as we read through Dvarim, let's read that, and let's think...
7b3, and so that's what I was reading.
Well, no, I'm on 8a, and we are, let's see, where are we? We are... Kikaton Kigadol Tishmaun, right? Which is the beginning of the fourth line on 8a. So let's read that together and think about what's wonderful actually is perhaps this story comes to illustrate that rule. So let's read it. Kikaton Kigadol Tishmaun. Amar Resh Lakish Sheyehe Chaviv Alecha Din Shel Pruta Kadin Shel Me'amane. So the small and the great alike shall you hear. This is the language of Torah. Amar Resh Lakish. Resh Lakish says about this. Sheyehe chaviv alecha, din shel pruta, kedin shel me'amene. That the matter which is worth only a penny, the case in which the stakes of the case is worth only a penny, is just as important or dear to you, the judge, right, as the matter involving 100 units of currency. 100, right? So that sounds like a great interpretation. And if it was me, I would say, Resh Lakish, that's brilliant. That must be what it means. The size here, the size that the Torah is referring to refers to the amount in controversy, right? But the Stam Gemara is not satisfied with at all. Lamai Hilchata, it says. What? Wait a second. What? When? For what kind of case could that possibly be the rule? E lema la ayune be umafsike shita. That is, if Resh Lakish is saying that this is about the kind of attention and decision that should be rendered, right? If when a small matter comes before a judge, we should give it as much attention, small because of the amount of controversy, we should give it as much attention as one involving a great sum of money, they say, pshita. In other words, obviously that's the case. Who would possibly think that because a small amount of controversy is here, I'm going to give it the back of my hand? In other words, the Gemara is saying at this point, I don't need a law from Torah to explicitly tell me that. That is a principle that goes without saying. Or they might even say, I can point you to 10 verses in the Torah in which that basic notion, be fair in judgment, would render that kind of a rule. And if that's the case, then we don't need Torah to come and tell us explicitly to do so. That's the rule. Have you encountered that rule in this class before, this kind of rule of interpretation? If something is too obvious, the Gemara is going to be unsatisfied with it. Because if it's obvious, it's obvious, and you don't need Torah to tell you that. It's actually a very strange hermeneutical principle. But you kind of understand it, right? I mean, If you open your VCR instructions, for example, your CD instructions, CD-ROM instructions, right? I don't know why. I mean, I'm not VCR instructions are a thing, I guess, right? If your Mac comes with an instruction about how to set it up, it doesn't say whenever you want to do enter, make sure you press the button marked enter on your keyboard. Right? That's pshita. That goes without saying. So the same principle of interpretation comes here. There are certain things that are simply so obvious that Torah wouldn't teach them to you. And if you say, well, that's what Torah is really saying, you've made a faulty inference. That has to be rejected in favor of something more unusual, something you might not have considered, which Torah does come to tell you. Following? So they knock out that understanding of Resh Lakish's statement right away, and they say, Ella... La'ak demuhe, right? Rather, what it comes to teach you is about the order of hearing cases. That is, you can't work your schedule in such a way that the case that you're really excited about, the giant class action litigation, comes at 9, and then at 5, you know, if there's time to hear it, there's some sort of landlord-tenant matter, right? Different court. I'm sorry. That would be in Lambeth. That would be in. That's true. Which is great, right? So it's possible. So again, imagine that. So if this story came here, what would it come to tell us, right? Imagine now we don't have the Agadah about Rav Kahana and Rav and the gracious host, not so gracious host. Instead, it gets plopped down here. Is there any light it could shed on this particular rule? Right. I mean, he has a big house with a guest room in it. Right. I mean, perhaps my picture. You know, he's being pally with the judge. He's a big shot, and so maybe Rob doesn't trust himself. Right. To hear him fairly for that reason. In other words, as interpreted here, Resh Lakish's statement has to do with kind of the psychology of a judge.
You know, but talking about Rav staying with this guy, Rav made a mistake. When he stayed with him, he had to pay him.
He should have paid him.
That's right. He didn't pay him, and that was a favor that brought the whole stuff here. So the point is that Rav made a mistake as a rabbinic leader or as a judge. Every place you go, you pay for yourself. And that would avoid all those situations.
Maybe it was before he was a judge.
But he wasn't rabbi at that time either. There was a story that we studied a year or two ago that one of the rabbis didn't agree to take anything. He wanted to pay for everything. So Rav was the one who initiated the mistake as a person of the court.
No fair remembering things from one day.
You should take you should put in as much effort to resolve the case involving one Pusha as a hundred.
Why is that Pusha?
I don't think it is. It's not realistic. A judge, in these cases, the judge is the attorney for both sides. He examines all the witnesses. He has to put in a fair amount of work. Is it worth his while over a trivial amount to examine the witnesses? What?
It might not be trivial to him.
Right.
It might be extraordinarily important to him.
Yeah, so then it's not.
Then it's not Jesus. So one other answer might be it's editing move. In other words, we have on the one hand the statement of Resh Lakish. It's nice, but it sounds a little platitudinous, right? But we have to include it. That's what Resh Lakish said this verse meant. But on the other hand, we have a rule, an existing rule perhaps, that you're not allowed to move cases around in their order. You have to hear them as they come to you. So the editor very cleverly takes the comment of Resh Lakish's, says if you really force things, that could teach you the existing rule of procedure that we have in our courts about the order in which cases should be heard. In order to get from one to the other, it uses one of the tools in its toolkit, which is the pshita objection, right? It can't be that what Resh Lakish is really just talking about taking care with small matters, because we would know that. That's a way of moving us to the next. I mean, what's beautiful always in the Bavli, and this has to do with, again, this is a question that was asked before the class started, why did the Bavli achieve the stature that it did? One reason I answered was because of the political power of those that promoted it in Bavel. But another answer, sorry?
We just lived the 2,000 years. In Israel, we only lived the 1,000 years.
There's that. There's certainly that. There's their age. Also, the Gaonet had a lot of political authority. But another answer is the editing of the Bavli is very, very subtle and beautiful. Right? And it's beautiful in precisely this way. It weaves you from one place to another with kind of, you know, a grab bag of, let's say, 20 to 30 different moves that you could do at any given moment. And one is the pshita objection. It keeps the argument going. The normal thing when you hear something beautiful like Resh Lakish says is to sit back and say, oh, lovely. End of conversation. They don't want the conversation, and they want to keep it going. So they say, you didn't have to tell me that. Just to keep, in other words, to get the next move going. That's another answer.
Are there implications in the word pshita? Does it mean like a simple-minded, or does it mean it's
obvious?
Not ad hominem attack.
No, it's certainly not ad hominem. That's just the shaklantaria of the Gemara. In other words, that's one of the objections the Gemara will have at its disposal to push an interpretation further. To push it further. And to also sort of introduce as necessary a reading that might seem more far-fetched, but the alternative reading is too obvious. to be satisfying.
I just wonder, with a lot of lawyers in the room and I don't know, today, if the same situation came and somebody came before a judge and he said, oh, I know you, you stayed at my house, whatever, you remember you stayed at my house, what would today the judge's obligation be?
I'll tell you a story that happened to me. I used to have a lawyer for my company many years ago that became a judge. Uh-huh. And one day I there was an issue, I had a car accident, and the insurance company pushed it through the court system, and we went to in front of a judge to hear the case. And who is the judge? That judge. And I didn't say anything, because I thought, oh, here is Rudisky, oh, I will get free, you know, I'll go home. So the guy looked at the paper, he looks, one eyes and was saying, can the guy will stand up? I said, no, it's you. He called me up to the FEMA and he said to his secretary, you need to write it down and say, I know this guy. I know this citizen. I respect this citizen and I cannot take this case. Mm. And he could take to the queue, to somebody else.
What about that you did that on your own? I mean, he did it on his own.
Right. I didn't
what
say
about
anything.
If two lawyers were in, you know, and you witnessed one of the person coming before the judge and saying to the judge, oh, Your Honor, you saved my house. What would
I think it would depend on the relationship, and this would be like from an objective point of view, a reasonable person. Would he think that the relationship is so close or beholden one to the other that no reasonable person could think the judge could judge fairly? I don't think, just on what we've heard, a judge who thought he could judge fairly, I think today, what most likely he would do, this has happened a lot, he would announce in court, I know this gentleman, I stayed at his home one time, and, you know, it doesn't matter to me, and does anybody object? Because, you know, the host himself could have said, in a different circumstance, I would prefer that you not judge the case. The other person, if both parties said they're okay, then he'd go ahead. If one party said he has a problem, you know, then... Judges have the other side, too. They're obligated to take a case if they're not disqualified.
So if there is a question, he asked the two guys, do you agree for me to be in the case? I mean, is it a real procedure?
Well, yeah. If the judge thinks he can be fair, he knows one party or lawyer or whatever, he might say, I know myself, it's not going to affect my judgment. He says to the parties, he might, you know, anybody have a problem? And then I think if one said, yes, I do, then the judge might actually have to decide if he's disqualified. Because I don't think a judge typically is supposed to say, all right, I won't sit on this case, if he's supposed to sit on the case.
Or
not disqualified, he's supposed to sit.
That's interesting.
You brought up a point about it, right? It's a small town. It's, you know, the legal community in New York is a pretty small town, too. And judges sit, and they know, they see the same lawyers all the time.
Right.
They know them from prior cases. And that's usually not a reason qualify yourself, but if you know the litigant in the Baraita, where the guy brought the basket of fruit, even without the fruit, there's a pre-existing commercial relationship between the judge and the litigant, and he said his landlord, and clearly I think that he would have to recuse himself.
That's fascinating.
He couldn't possibly sit on that case because this is his tenant.
Now that, what's interesting is that nothing in the Baraita, in the story that's told there would suggest that absent that move on the part of the tenant, he would have been obliged to recuse himself. And even more, according to Tosafot, he didn't have to recuse himself. So that's...
I don't agree with that.
Well, look, you can't... It's not a question of whether you agree. The question is, what is the law in that case? Now, we can say that he acted rightly by recusing himself. But the question is, was that simply ethical conduct? Was that within the letter of the law? And that's sort of what we're... All of these cases are marginal cases, right? They're not clear-cut cases. This one falls on the margins in one way. I mean, I think that your judgment is a fair one. The question is, does the law support you there?
Isn't the law that you should be impartial regardless of your connection with the litigants?
So now we go back to the disagreement.
You don't like him, you like him. He's a big shot. He's a small fry. It's a big case. Well, isn't the law either I thought judge the case based on the facts and be impartial?
So that's wonderful. So now we just did. Now we put meat on the bones of why I do think there's a machloket between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Elazar on Lotakil Lefanim. Why there's actually a disagreement between the two, right? Because if we now that we've seen some of the implications, now we've talked this out, this is very helpful to me to understand what's going on, right? This is why this kind of learning makes all the difference. Now when we really thought about it, we understand what's up between the two. Is the law that you remain impartial irrespective of your knowledge of the litigants, or is the law, if you have either, you know, if you're familiar with or have some pre-existing commercial relationship with the litigant, you have to recuse yourself because we don't trust you to be impartial. It sounds like Rabbi Yehuda by saying, to understand that lo takiru fanim, meaning you simply are not permitted to know the person, is in the latter camp. We simply don't trust you to be impartial towards people whom you know, whereas Rabbi Elazar seems to be saying on the pshat level, no, we can't get away from having relations with people. Your obligation is to remain impartial whether or not you know the litigants. And that might be the heart of what they're saying. That, again, that's not what Rashi thinks is going on there, but that might actually be originally what is going on there. Yeah.
So far, we don't know what the correct... What, is there no final answer?
Ah, so great. So then at a certain point, I'm sure the rabbis talked to you about this, these very, very ambiguous stories and laws and kind of inconclusive arguments get codified, right? So if you want to look, what I mean, if you look at your Talmud page, there's a way to... I didn't check this out for you, but we can do it now. It's worth seeing how it works. Do you see... I'm on Chet Aleph, right? 8a. Do you see right at Silna, the first word of 8a, there's a bolded Aleph?
Yeah.
That brings you up to the upper left-hand corner, where you have a thing called the Ein Mishpat Ner Mitzvah, right? That helps you track down what the Psak Halakha, what the codified law ends up being, based on the way that later readers of the Talmud understood this, right? So, up there on the upper left-hand corner, it says, now this is good, you're testing me, this is the sort of thing I would have to do like my second year. It says, my, with a little chupchik, that means the Mishnah Torah, Maimonides, Perek Kaf Gimel, in the 23rd chapter, Mihilchot Sanhedrin, of the laws of the Sanhedrin, Halacha Zayin, the seventh law there, and then it gives you the smug, gives you other sources. So you can go see the way it got codified. The very fact that it hinges on the word Tesilna, I am disqualified. That's a better translation than unfit. I'm disqualified. Suggests to me that the way this does get codified is that he would be in such a circumstance disqualified. In other words, the codification mark that brings you to the source hinges on the word I am disqualified. To me, that suggests that's probably the way that the rabbis understood it. If that's the case, that sounds like it's at odds with what Tosafot says, which says this is over and above the letter of the law. This is, you know, laudable conduct, even though it might also be a kind of a shirking of work if he's fit to hear the case. It's laudable conduct, but it's not strictly required. So I don't know the law of judges very, very well. In fact, I'll never know that because the way that we get smicha, the way that we get ordained, we don't get tested on these particular laws. But if I was over at Chov HaFei Torah, the ultra-Orthodox places or Orthodox places, I would be required to know that it's the bottom line there. Yeah?
Well, the Talmud suggests that there's a third alternative,
yeah,
which is that it's not simply is or is not, but there's the appearance. And the fact that this was public, and that, I mean, you know, the lawyers, I think there was something that was, that gave the appearance that there was a relationship that was untoward, you know, beyond, and that would imply some influence. And we're a religion where appearance is very important.
Absolutely.
If a rabbi is doing something, he's got to really, you know, get himself away from the appearance that the rabbi is breaking the law, even if he's not. And the judge has a similar kind of weight and authority. And I think if there is the appearance, then you have to go beyond, which is to get yourself out of that situation where there's the appearance that the judgment will not be completely fair and unfair.
Called the Marit Ayn.
Marit Ein, or Moris Ein, is there sometimes.
The Marit, the means that the eye can see.
Appearance.
Maybe that's behind.
Appearance and propriety.
Maybe that's behind Rav's reaction. Apparently, it was host. Maybe he was at a benefit. Guy's house.
So much money in
there. He was looking forward to trying the case because this is a real big shot and it's a big, important, interesting case. And the guy comes and says, "What's in my house? Now I have to disqualify."
That's right.
So now
it's hard to see sort of a per se rule that regardless of what the conflict is or the appearance of conflict, nevertheless, I, as a judge, will be able to remove myself from all of those elements and decide fairly. I don't. It doesn't sound like you could have a workable rule like that. So if not, then you start having a slice where we are
absolutely.
On it.
Absolutely. Right. In some sense, just to go back, if I'm understanding Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Elazar correctly, both of their proposals are unworkable. It's unworkable to disqualify yourself every time you have some, however tenuous, relationship with a litigant. And it's also untenable to not disqualify yourself, simply saying, I know myself, I can remain impartial, even if your relationship is quite close. So you need to find some sort of in-between between those two for a workable law. Absolutely. Great. So let's move on, because I think what comes up next, to me, is incredibly fascinating. And it's one of these weird things where you think there is some sort of hashgacha, there's some sort of providence, because it brought up into my mind the next little story, a passage which I was so curious about. I wrote my rabbi in Jerusalem some months ago, and he said, I know what you're thinking of. I've never studied Masechet Sanhedrin. It's on Sanhedrin 7a. So you came to the thing that I was thinking of 2 weeks ago.
I was writing to it.
So there you go. So it's very strange. So now we're moving on. We're back in Dvarim Aleph. And the next law is Lo tadguru mipnei ish ki amishpat lelohim hu. Do not be afraid before a human being, because judgment belongs to God. It's a great line. So it gets quoted. You see where we are? We are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 lines down from the top. Second to last word, Lo Taguru. With me? On the 8A? Ignore the bracketed remark. That means it was included in this girsa, but it's read to be a corruption kind of almost universally. So we go right to Ki Amishpat Lelohim Hu. Okay? Now we're trying to understand what that means. Because judgment belongs to God. Amar Rabbi Chama, Rabbi Chanina. So Rabbi Chama, in the name of Rabbi Chanina, said the following: Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Holy One, blessed be He, said, Lo dayan l'rashayim shenotlin mizeh mamon v'notnim l'zeh. It's not bad enough for evil people that they take from this person, they take money from this person and give it to that person, shelo kadin, in a way that the law does not prescribe, extra-legally. Ela shematrichin oti lahachzir mamon lebe'alav. But they also trouble me. They also inconvenience me when I have to return it back to its proper owner. Very strange. What is the connection between the two? So here Rashi is very helpful. Ki amishpat Elohim hu. Here's what Rashi says. Ki ilu ata dan umotzi mamon miyad hakadosh baruch hu shaharei alav lahachzir mamon lebe'alav. When you, now we have to fill in the facts a little bit, it's as though when you judge improperly, you are taking money from the hand of God, not from this litigant and giving it to that, but from God himself. Because it is God's responsibility, at the end of the day, to allocate money appropriately, which is itself is a complicated idea, but this is why my thought went back to an earlier statement. Now this is in joining the judges, but back on 7a, this is what was said, and this is the thing that struck me so much. And you might remember this. Ahuda hava kama va azil. There was a man that used to go around and say, the azil mebedina shakal glima lizamer zemer. When you leave the courthouse, having lost the shirt on your back, you should sing a song. Do you remember this? Is this something you learned together? V'lizil be'orcha, and go on your way. Amar le Shmuel Rav Yehuda. Now Shmuel was explaining this phrase. Kra kativ. There's a verse that supports this. V'gam kol ha'am hazeh al mekomo yavo b'shalom. And all the people, wherever they may be, should go in peace. Now again, we have to go to Rashi to understand this. And believe me, the payoff is great. Ho'il, you should sing a song. Ho'il v'din emet dano, lo hifsid klum. Because the losing party in any litigation, if his case was judged justly, because he lost, but his case was judged justly, he actually didn't lose anything. That is to say, whatever he had, which he then had to give up because of the verdict, wasn't in fact his to begin with. That is the nature of true justice, right? When justice is being done, all that's taken off of you is something that was improperly yours to begin with. Ela gzela v'hotzi yom yado. Rather, what he had was, as it were, a kind of a theft or a conversion, right? And if he was taking as his what was not his to begin with. And by taking it from him, the judge has removed ill-gotten gains from his hand. And to explain what Rav Shmuel said, why is it that he thinks the gam kol ha'am hazeh, the entire people, al mekomo, wherever they be, yavo b'shalom, should be in peace? He says, lo shna zakai v'lo shna chayav kulan b'mashma. That is, everybody should be at peace, ideally, whether they're held to be guilty or innocent, whether held to be liable or not, because where God's will is being done and true justice is being done, they should be happy that they are in a state of shalom. That is, justice... One second. What's brilliant about this thought, now, and so now in our sugya, where we're reading right now, we see the corresponding view from the judge's perspective. This is how I think it's being said. If you as a judge see this poor sad sack over here and this rich, you know, predatory landlord over here, and he, the rich man, has the better of the case and the poor man the weaker, there's something in you that might say, you know what, let me just fudge things a little bit so as to redistribute wealth, right? And it's precisely there that Rabbi Chanina, Chama, the name of Rabbi Chanina, says, by doing so, by taking from a party who himself is not liable and giving it to another party, for whatever reason, you're stealing from God. Why from God? Because God has allocated these things according to law. And law determines the rightful owner. Right? It's actually a fascinating idea of the difference between our view of litigation and justice and a view where you really have God as the ultimate litigator, the ultimate legislator, that is. Yeah.
So there is a saying in the Bible, "Ganav mi ganav tachu." And here we say that
a thief who steals from a thief is exempt from punishment.
And here you say that if one guy takes money and gives to another guy, he takes money, and all of them are the shayim. So there is ganav mi ganav. So why...
Excellent. So just to break that out, in your understanding then, a judge who, let's say, for some extra legal reason, takes pity on a litigant and manipulates the thing so as to take money from one to another, he's nothing more than a common thief, as you're saying.
No, let's put the judge as God. Let's give him the fair ability to judge correctly. But why we have, you say that God spread the wealth in a way that even if the weak loser lose, he still need to be happy because that's the way God wanted the truth to be.
I think that's what's going on here. I'm not saying that I...
So why if God spread judgment or money according to the real truth, why can I bring up the truth?
I see what you're saying. The difference here is I'm not saying that the existing distribution of wealth, I'm not saying, and I don't think the Gemara is saying or Torah is saying, the existing distribution of wealth is ordained by God. What's being said is that the laws to determine who has the better of a particular case, if they're understood and implied fairly and correctly, are divine laws. That is, it may be that society as currently constituted is utterly corrupt and not at all the way that God ordained it. But if you, as the judge, are charged with enforcing God's law, but the outcome for some reason displeases you, so you manipulate those rules, know, says Rabbi Chanina, right? Know that what you're doing is theft. That's quite different from saying that if a thief steals from a thief, it's God ordained and therefore...
No, that's not what I'm saying. Ah. If a thief steals from a thief and both of them come into court and the judge will say, the younger thief or the later one, it's your money and forget about it.
I don't think he would say that, obviously.
But that's the halacha, ganav mi ganav patur.
The halacha?
Yeah.
Right.
You mean don't interrupt it because...
This is the halacha, this is ganav mi ganav patur.
This is a serious thing, right? I mean, what happens when the prior owner doesn't have rights to the object that he's suing for? That's a case that shows up.
The way I understand it is that if somebody steals from somebody who stole, then this guy got his punishment that that property was stolen from him, and the other guy, because he punished the other one, is free of charge, whatever they call it. That's the way I would look at it, because you need to punish the first one.
I don't know.
But this is not in court today.
The property belongs to the original owner.
That sounds right. I mean, it sounds to me like you have to return the object to the original proper owner. The question is whether you also then punish the second thief for the theft. That I don't know. But what I want to just draw your attention to is how different, and sometimes I feel like the Talmud is talking about a universe that I can understand. It's very, very close to my understanding. But the idea that we should sing a song when we lose, because God's will is being done, is, on the one hand, beautiful, and also utterly alien to the way that we relate. Of course, I'm sure it's alien to the way they related at the time, but our whole worldview has changed from then. Yeah.
Right, well, maybe it's partly because the way the Torah is interpreted by the rabbis in the Talmud, there's a perfectly correct answer, but also maybe it's knowable. Our law is, I don't think anyone has ever thought that in, let's say, the American system of law, that there is a, that we know the law and that there is a right answer. Our system of law has evolved as a kind of a dialectical thing. You know, you have a principle, that's true, but that doesn't resolve anything. You have one side arguing here, the other side says this is the right, and in that particular matter the decision is made. But I don't think, we don't get to think about our decisions as that's the right answer. All we know is that's what the judge decided. We think he did the best that he can do, and we'll go on to the next case. So nobody is happy in our system. What you say is really very interesting and important, because if you had the feeling that the law was, that there is law, capital L, and that it's knowable, and that there is a right decision for every case, and only one right decision, well, if the right decision is made, how can anybody be unhappy? The whole Madoff thing, it's very complicated, but the idea, the way the rule is that that's pretty general. Well, what you put in, you might get. But other monies that you might have gotten, it's really you just taking it from somebody else.
Because, yeah, you need to return it. You collected money
from people. In other words, suppose in order to pay, I wanted to redeem my holdings, so he took money from you, the next investor, and he didn't have any accounts really, he just had money coming in and out, and he gave it to me. So when I object, I say, well, you know, why do I have to give this money back? It's really this case.
That's
even the other money is, in a sense, you know, there's no particular justification for getting anything back, because it's all, the only people who got money, they got it stolen, in a sense, from from the next person who adjusts the vest?
I think, I'm not sure that's this case. In other words, there you have a mess. I mean, the Madoff, you have a mess, which is that there's not enough money to go around. And except for Madoff, everybody else was in good faith. And so people who are in good faith are going to have to lose out, right? The case that I think is being imagined here is different. There is, let's assume, there is a right answer here. But the right answer, for some reason, displeases the judge, right? So the judge manipulates the law in such a way to do justice as the judge sees it, right? In the Madoff case, you know, you need lots of experts to figure out what the most equitable solution is. It's not like there's a simple stock, there's a simple outcome that we could just disregard because we take pity on the widows and the orphans. But I hear what you're saying.
Are you reading this to say that the judge is one of these cases where he's favoring the poor as opposed to having taken a bribe? That he's made an unjust decision, right? He's made a wrong decision. And are you saying it's because he was trying to favor somebody he felt sorry for?
This is a place where you have to fill in a great deal. It's not clear. I mean, the Pasuk says, lo taguru mipne ish. And taguru is a strange word. But don't be afraid of people. Your mind, judge, should be on God, not on the identities of the parties. Whether it's to favor one because you have some sort of corrupt relationship with them, or whether for any other reason. You know, even if you're erring on the other side, let's say, and saying, I know what the outcome is here, but it will break this poor widow's heart for me to render it, don't think you can get away with that. Because when you allocate money in a way that the law doesn't require, it's theft. And it's not just theft from the losing party, it's theft from God. That, I think, is a different situation than the Madoff one. Yeah, please.
I mean, if we take this Kiyomishpah, novel idea, I think what's implied here is that if you talk about the case of a man who leaves the court without his shirt that he came in with, he should feel happy. Why? Because it wasn't his to begin with. Now he's unburdened of the guilt of it. Here you have a judge who may feel, why should this man, I grew up with both, we went to school together. This guy who barely put food on the table, and this guy is fabulously wealthy. And now he's making a claim against this poor man. I think what this Chava says is that's not even a consideration, because the way things are in the world, it didn't happen because somebody decided or somebody exercised some power or skill or gift. It's because that's God's plan. We don't know why it's like that. It's obvious that it seems unfair. One man should be rich, one man should be poor, one man should be healthy, one should be ill. The fact is, God has a plan, and apparently he's put a lot of work into it. The note here is helpful. If you decide, based on your sympathies, to render a judgment that you know is not 100% the way you see the facts, because you feel you will be doing a mitzvah to this man, in the end, God has to come back. It uses the word inconvenience. It's taken him a long time to set up this plan. You disrupt it for whatever reason. He has this man rich, this man poor. Now, you've upset that plan. He has to come back, go back to square one, figure out how to get the money back to the rightful owner that you gave to somebody because you are sympathetic and compassionate. But that's irrelevant.
So I would say there's a more...
It's really amazing how... whoever wrote it, well, I'm a fool. He brought it off. If I were a rich man, would it be so bad for God to give me a little more? Why do I have to be so poor?
So let me be more modest about this. Lest we think that somebody cites Talmud. Lest we think that redistribution is like a sur mina Torah, right? That some sort of tax program which redistributes wealth is what's being addressed here. I think we have to be a little bit more modest in our claims, right? Which is that this is about instructions to judges in their capacity as judges, right? To say that what this statement supports is that as I think is being suggested, that the existing distribution of wealth as God ordained is not at all, I think, what's happening here. I think this is about what you, in your capacity as a judge, whose sole function is to enforce God's law, can and can't do. If, when you're confronted with a litigant who has to leave without a shirt on his back, your heart breaks, there are remedies for that. You can give more tzedakah. You can invite that man to live in your house. You can lobby for there being a greater redistributive tax plan, right? He's simply saying, and it's a more modest point, qua judge, in your capacity as a judge, don't think you can manipulate these rules and think you're doing justice, right? That I think is a slightly, in other words, it's along those lines, but I think, again, what's interesting here is that this is really judges talking to themselves about how they should act as judges, not what society writ large ought to look like, or, God forbid, some sort of ultra-conservative vision that this is really against the vision of Torah, that those at the bottom are there because they deserve it, necessarily. But again and again, we're enjoined to think about the powerless in society and to help them. Right.
Don't we say that it is not enough to do justice, that you must appear to do justice? It has to look just.
I think that's right too. Absolutely.
But on this idea of it being more modest, which makes sense, how do you reconcile that with the introduction here of God and the Holy One? I mean, it's in the language of this portion we've read. So just when you're talking about this is the way the judge should act, this is what is being taught here, you really don't need that. I don't see what the judgment is.
Great. So, I mean, I think, you know, again, this is a unit here which has begun with Va'atzaveh et shofteichem. I commanded your judges, colon. Right? And everything that follows up until, unfortunately we're not going to get there, but it ends with a second command on the part of Moshe. At the very end at verse 18, Va'asaveh etchem. And I commanded you, which the Gemara, next week you'll see, the Gemara says there's kind of two corresponding commands. There's a command that Moshe is giving here to the judges, and this law about not being affrighted of a human being, but the judge belongs to God, that belongs to the commands to the judges. And then there's a separate command to the people, right? So however we understand that phrase, and importing God into it, it has to be something that's addressed to the judges because of its placement in these verses. And that's, I think, why, again, just pay attention to the editing. The kind of adage that's attributed here to Rabbi Hanina in the name of Rabbi Barhama, could have gone anywhere. It doesn't strictly relate to this verse. By appending it to this verse, it becomes instructions to judges. But it could go to any, it could be to an everyday thief. A thief doesn't just inconvenience the society, it inconveniences God as well. Could be. That's not how it's brought by the Bala Sugya, by the editor of the Sugya, who makes it part of the instructions to judges.
You were surprised before about when you leave the cold after they took your shirt off, be happy and sing a song. Every morning we say, V'samachta b'chelkecha. I mean, this is part of our...
You should be happy in your portion.
Whatever it is. So I think this is in line with our belief. So,
there you go. On that note, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Used to treating the word Elohim,
it can be both.
Yeah.
It means God. I think it sounds like it's in the verse, don't be afraid in front of a human being. Judgment belongs to, if it meant judge there, that's more human being. And it also seems strange to tell judge, don't worry, the judgment belongs to the judges.
Well,
it could be.
Don't worry about that. Judgment is... I mean, all of the commentary is God. I don't know.
It could be.